Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Barack Obama delivered his much-anticipated speech to the Muslim world today from the Egyptian capital, Cairo, before 3,000 invited guests and broadcast on state-run television. The president pledged to seek a new beginning between the U.S. and Muslims around the world. He acknowledged the skepticism about whether that's possible, and he appealed directly to young people.
There's so much fear. So much mistrust that has built up over the years. But if we choose to be bound by the past, we will never move forward. And I want to particularly say this to young people of every faith in every country. You, more than anyone, have the ability to reimagine the world, to remake this world.
Michael Slackman is Cairo Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and he joins us from Cairo. And Michael, how would you say that the president's speech has gone over in Egypt?
Well, I would say initially the overall reaction is very positive, not just in Egypt, but we've talked to people throughout the Arab world, from Bahrain to Algeria, and it's gone over very well.
You wrote that most people were expecting more than rhetoric from President Obama in this speech. So if you're getting positive reaction, does that mean he delivered?
Well, I think you have to look at this in two ways. One is in terms of the immediate reaction to the rhetorics of his speech, to his very presence here in Cairo. I spent the time during the speech hanging out in a coffee shop with about 20 Egyptian men, and they were almost giddy. They were, like, perplexed. They're so used to, or they feel so accustomed to being demonized by the West, that to see the President of the United States in Cairo was almost a joyous occasion for them. So they were very happy about that. Regionally, people were extremely pleased that the President made as many references as he did from the Quran. Again, they're not accustomed to seeing American presidents seem to both understand Islam in an emotional way and also an intellectual way. So they were excited about that. But as I said, the minute this speech was over, people asked, okay, now what? You know, the president did a great job. He came here. We liked his words. But now what?
What were the issues that most people wanted to hear him talk about or lay out an action plan to deal with?
I mean, bear in mind, this speech was billed as a speech to the Muslim world, but everybody was listening. Folks in Israel were listening, folks across the Islamic world were listening, folks in the West were listening. Different constituencies had different needs. Within the Arab-Islamic world, no, I would say broader, within the Islamic world in general, they were looking for discussion of pressuring Israel and moving forward on development of a Palestinian state. The president did not offer anything new in that regard, and they saw that as disappointing.
What about him saying that the only resolution is for both sides to be met through two states? And in his comments about the settlements, he was very strong about not accepting continued Israeli settlements, and he used the term Palestine, and those were not strong enough words?
Palestine did reverberate with some people. They were kind of excited about that. They're accustomed to the President of the United States or Americans in general using the term creation of a Palestinian state in the future. So there were moments, but you have to understand the President crafted a balanced speech in which he presented the Palestinian and Israeli conflict in balanced terms, which of course he needs to do. But this constituency in the Arab world doesn't view it in balanced terms. They view themselves, rightly or wrongly, as victims of Israeli aggression. This is their view. I'm not advocating. And so when the president said the Palestinians or Hamas have to stop firing weapons into Israel, the crowd that I was with immediately started screaming back at the television, saying, why aren't you saying that to the Israelis? You have said nothing about Gaza.
One of the biggest sources of tension between the U.S. And the Muslim world also has been the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The president mentioned both of those, saying about the war in Iraq that it was a war of choice that provoked strong differences around the world. And about the war in Afghanistan, if the U.S. could be confident that there were not violent extremists in Afghanistan, then maybe all the U.S. troops could leave Afghanistan. How did his comments about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan resonate with people?
Again, taken in the context of all of the way the president presented his argument, it was very well received. But it's not the kind of core issue. It's not the pivotal issue. The pivotal issue is Israel-Palestine, on the streets in Egypt, on the streets in Jordan, and on the streets in Algeria. Now, I don't mean to leave you with the impression that people came away from this with a sour mood. They didn't. It's quite the contrary. They were very, very happy, very impressed, and very almost relieved that a leader of the United States came to Cairo and spoke in the terms that he spoke in. But they're very cynical. They feel that they've heard this before. They remember when George Bush first came to office and he talked about peace. They've heard President Obama now talk tough about settlements and not do anything yet. They're waiting to see, you know, what happens next. He talked about having a partnership. He talked about dealing with each other in terms of mutual respect. It really resonated here.
What about his comments about human rights and women's equality? Went out of his way to say that women do have a choice to live traditional roles, but women and men don't have to make the same choices necessarily to be equal. What did that mean to people watching and listening to the speech?
People appreciated the veiled references to Egypt and the need for democracy here. People appreciated that he talked about the need to have freedom and accountability. And as you said, they appreciated the talk of the discussion of women's rights. What they really appreciated was he wasn't preaching it, though. He was saying, this is where we stand. These are our values. This is what we believe you should do. But we also recognize that no country can force any country in what to do. Liberals and democracy activists have said to me that President Obama's approach will do far more good for them and for their ability to operate in their countries than anything President Bush did, in spite of his very strong pro-democracy rhetoric. By going a little easier, by backing off, by not threatening the stability or the perceived stability of these regimes, the folks that I've talked to in the Arab world who felt that they had to be silent for the last 8 years now feel there's room to operate.
All right. Michael Slackman, Cairo Bureau Chief for The New York Times, joining us from Cairo today after President Obama's speech there. Michael, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
We turn now to Hisham Kassem, a longtime human rights and democracy activist and former publisher of the independent Egyptian paper, The Cairo Times. And Hisham, we just heard from Michael Slackman about how President Obama addressed the question of democracy in the Middle East. Let's listen to what the president said.
Suppressing ideas never succeeds in making them go away. America respects the right of all peaceful and law-abiding voices to be heard around the world, even if we disagree with them. And we will welcome all elected peaceful governments, provided they govern with respect for all their people.
And Hisham Kassem, you were in the group of people, the 3,000 invited guests, for President Obama's speech in Egypt today. His comments about democracy, what do you think that those suggested to the audience, at least, and what do they mean to you regarding President Obama's stand on democracy?
It was the bare minimum, he could say, because the international community, especially given that this is the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, were looking out there, and I think what was said was the bare minimum that could have been said. Mm.
So what would you have liked to have heard from him?
I would have liked to hear more of a commitment to the issue of democracy and human rights. He said enough where we're not going to be very critical, but we're going to be following closely how committed he is to the issue of civil liberties.
And I'm wondering, what would you have liked to have heard from him that would have indicated that he was making a stronger commitment, specifically?
We're talking about the tone, the rhetoric, to increase a little more over what he said.
When President Bush spoke in 2003 about the need for democracy in the Middle East, he mentioned specific regimes, including Egypt, and that was considered a break in U.S. policy. But critics said that the Bush policy change was only short-lived. Did that policy by former President Bush make a difference, do you think?
Oh, definitely. We're talking about human rights organizations in Saudi Arabia. We're talking about women elected in the Kuwaiti parliament, multi-candidate presidential elections in Egypt, and I can go on. You know, it's a long list. It's a pity that President Bush did a U-turn in the last 2-3 years of his administration over the issue after the Hamas victory in the elections. But it's a different Middle East. The regimes now are trying to roll back that space. They're not being very successful, but the momentum that was created by that commitment, it does not exist. And we were hoping to get something clear out of President Obama. And while I can't say it was a total disappointment. But again, you know, for him to say things like that you can't force political systems on people, etc., is factually incorrect, because what we do have is forcing authoritarian regimes on people by the support of the United States. So maybe what he said today was a little out of place. But on the whole, I don't think it will create a fallout with the Obama administration, but the rights community will be observing and waiting to get a better understanding of where he stands.
Hisham Qassem, a longtime human rights and democracy activist, also a former publisher of the independent Egyptian newspaper, the Cairo Times. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We turn now to Rhonda Shadid, a Boston-based attorney who was born in Egypt. She's with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Massachusetts and a founding member of the Center for Arab Culture. And Rhonda, you just heard from Hisham Qassem, and he expressed disappointment, really, about President Obama's speech. He says not enough commitment was shown for human rights and democracy. Would you have liked to have heard more on that from the president as well?
I would have liked to hear more of that, but I didn't expect any more. This is an introductory speech. It's the first time that he addresses the Muslim world at large. I like the fact that he did not try to lecture, because as many Egyptian fellows would have said, stop lecturing us. Your house is built out of glass, and you're coming to lecture us about democracy. So I certainly understand where Mr. Qassem comes from. In my family, one of my uncles was in prison for 20 years because he was a political prisoner. I understand about all the journalists that are in prisons and that are being tortured, and the ones that are in prison without charges in Egypt for many, many years in political prisons. Mm. But at the same time, I think there's always too much expectation always put in foreign in big foreign countries, whether it's Britain, whether it's the European Union, whether it's America, that the help always has to come from outside. And I'm a firm believer that we have to look within and build up a grassroots. We have to organize from within in order to be able to fight the battle. We can't always rely on someone else. I certainly would have liked to see Obama speak a little bit more about what he understands, what is happening in the Arab world. He sort of brushed over it. He said that certainly democracy cannot happen in a place where there's he didn't say corruption per se, but where governments are stealing of its people. And he said that democracy can only flourish in a place where there's education. And,
right.
But I it's exactly what I expected, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, there could have been more.
Yeah,
we'll continue. We're speaking with Rhonda Shadid, an attorney based here in Boston. She's with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Massachusetts. And as we said, we'll have more with her after a quick break. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young, and we're talking today about President Obama's speech at Cairo University. Rhonda Shadid is a graduate of that school. She's a native Egyptian and an attorney, now living in the United States, and she's active in Arab-American cultural issues here. And Rhonda, the big question today was exactly how President Obama was going to address the question of the Israelis and the Palestinians. And he said, on the one hand, he does not tolerate certain activities on the part of the Israelis, but he says that the situation has become intolerable for the Palestinians. Do you also think that in this particular instance, the president said minimally what he had to say, and that's not surprising, but you wish he would have said more?
I certainly do.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I was encouraged by is that he envisaged a two-state solution. He obviously started the whole thing by talking about or saying that he is giving his support for He will support the Israeli state all over anything. He is vehemently for a two-state solution that both parties have to be treated equally. But what will happen in case possibly that if there wasn't a two-state solution, maybe he should have directed the Israelis a little bit to say, if we don't have a two-state solution, then we will only be left with a one-state solution. He definitely should have spoken more about what happened in Gaza. We were very disappointed in that regard. There were so many hopes at the beginning when we were supporting Obama and all electing or many people electing Obama, that after he was elected that he would actually speak up, and although he wasn't still in government, but that he would say something about the bombardment of Gaza.
Right.
But he hasn't done so.
Right. Well, Rhonda Shadid, a Boston-based attorney born in Egypt. She is with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Massachusetts and a founding member of the Center for Arab Culture. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, we turn now to a different kind of view from the Arab world, one that has many Arabs laughing at themselves. Comedian Dean Abdallah is a Palestinian-Italian-American. He organizes the Arab-American Comedy Festival in New York and similar festivals across the Middle East. He joins us from Oman, where he's performing this week. And Dean, President Obama didn't use much humor in his speech today in Cairo. Did you find any material for your performances?
I'm going to look at it much more thoroughly. I think there is some good things from it, though. I mean, no one threw a shoe at him, which is very good. The last American president did have a shoe thrown at him. So that was a great set right off the bat. No footwear.
Right. Well, that's a good sign. Well, one common theme that the president reiterated throughout his speech was sort of finding these commonalities between Muslims and the West. He spoke of mutual goals and mutual interests. Do you think that there is some common ground here that you've been able to find, at least through humor, that the president was onto something here?
I think so. I mean, I've seen it firsthand. I'm performing in the city of Muscat in Oman this week, and people are laughing at our jokes, and they're in English. 90% of the jokes I do in the States, I'm doing for the Arab audiences, and they get the jokes, and they laugh at it, and they also laugh at themselves. I make fun of them smoking all the time. I went to a gym. There was an ashtray on a treadmill. That's how crazy the smoking over here. I'm not even exaggerating, but they laugh at themselves. They have no problem, and that to me shows our common humanity that often as Americans we don't happen to see in American media yet.
You actually have a riff on smoking in your act. You mentioned the ashtray on the treadmill, but let's listen to this one.
In America, we have public service announcements trying to get you to quit smoking. Here you'd have like, don't be a quitter. Smoke to the end, please. Brought to you by the Jordanian Medical Association.
Well, the smoking is certainly one stereotype, but I think that for many of us in the U.S., there's also a stereotype of much of the Arab world being repressive and not being particularly funny, and you're obviously breaking that stereotype. Do you find that that's probably, those jokes about those stereotypes are probably where you get the biggest reaction?
Holding a mirror up to their society, they laugh at a lot. The interesting thing is there's no history of stand-up comedy here in this region. It's only over the last couple of years been introduced through live performances, and YouTube has really bridged the gap. And so now we always have these workshops wherever we go and find mostly it's young people who are Arab who want to do comedy. Most of them do it in English, and they're funny, and they're learning stand-up comedy, and people are embracing it in great ways. I mean, I'm here. It's literally 122 degrees yesterday, and there are people outside smoking. It's so hot, but still they need something lit and on fire in their mouth. And still they laugh at it because they know it's true. It's not mocking in a way that's demonizing or demeaning. This is more playful, and it's from a place of love. And they know my intentions and the intentions of the comedians is in a good-spirited way. Just have a little levity.
What are some of the other differences in culture that you tend to make fun of during your acts?
Well, I mean, we'll talk about the love for haggling. Like, for example, when my cousins from the Middle East come to America, we go shopping, and we'll be in a store, and the cashier will say, that's $10. My cousin goes, I give you $8.50. And the cashier says, we're at Macy's, sir. We can't negotiate. And that's, while it's funny, it's true. The Middle East is all about negotiating and haggling. And certainly the Israelis haggle as well. So you've got two of the greatest hagglers in the world together. Neither one wants to pay full price for anything, including peace, it seems. So, I mean, I'm hopeful that in time President Obama will understand the gamesmanship of the Middle Eastern people, Arabs and Israelis, in negotiating. And that can only be helpful to him. You know, I'm saying it comedically, but there is truth to it behind that. And that's where the stereotype comes from. It's truthful.
Before President Barack Obama's speech in Cairo, you had some advice for him when he's addressing a Muslim audience. You said, for example, that he should dress like a hip Arab guy. He should bring up his middle name a lot. Specifically, what were you trying to get at when you gave him those tips?
Well, I want him to reach out to the Arab street, which is the average Arab, not the diplomat or leader of the country who always wears a suit, but more like the Arab guy, like my cousins, like open shirt, maybe they have like a gold chain or two. I see President Obama wore a jacket and a very nice blue tie today, but it would have been cooler, a couple, just like two buttons, maybe three buttons open, show a looseness. And he did use his name Hussein in the speech, so I think he took my advice, which I was very happy about that. And he made the point in his speech that he did grow up in Indonesia, where it's a very strong Muslim influence. And he has a respect for the culture and the religion and the culture that goes behind the religion.
Dean Obaidullah, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Comedian Dean Obaidullah spoke with us from Amman. Back after the news, here and now. Just after midnight on May 21st, a man wearing a mask and carrying a baseball bat rushed into the Shirley Express convenience store in Shirley, Long Island. He ordered the store's owner, Mohammed Sohail, to give him the money in the cash register. Sohail grabbed the unloaded shotgun that he keeps behind the counter. He told the thief to drop his bat. And what happened next is one of those acts of random kindness that deserves some attention. Mohammed Sohail joins us from his convenience store on Long Island. Hello, Mohammed.
How are you doing, Deborah?
Okay. Well, thanks for being with us. Can you tell us what happened after you confronted this robber?
He get down, and I put the gun to him, and he telling me, I'm sorry. I have no money. I have no food. I have no job. He's crying like a baby, really crying. And I tell him, I said, promise me, you never rob anybody's again. He say, I never rob anybody's again. I say, okay. And then I go in the back again. I open my cash register. I take a $40. Then I say, take this $40. Go home, feed your family. When he get a $40, he's very impressed to me. He liked me. He say, you are very nice. I want to be a Muslim just like you. I say, what? You want a Muslim just like me?
And when the thief said that, what did you say to him when he said he wanted to be a Muslim?
I say, okay, stand up, put your right hand up. I say, La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah. He said, La ilaha illallah, Muhammad Rasulullah. I say, congratulations, now you are a Muslim. Your name is Nawaz Sharif Sattari. Take a bread, let me grab the milk for you. When I come to get the milk, I come back, the person is gone. He left then.
Do you think you'll ever see him again?
I don't know. I wish I want to be see him again, and if you want to help, I'm going to help him.
You came to this country from Pakistan 20 years ago.
That's correct.
And you describe yourself as a devout Muslim. What role do you think your religion played in you making this decision to have mercy on this man who came into your store with a baseball bat and tried to rob you, and you decided instead to give him some money and help him out because of his emotional display?
Deborah, let me explain to you. You know, we just like if somebody even do a bad thing, you know, give it back.
So in other words, just because someone is going to do something bad to you doesn't mean that you do something bad back to them.
Give it back. No. I feel comfortable myself. I help this person. I help his family.
Are you concerned, though, that there's the possibility that he could try to rob someone else now that he got away with
this? You want to know, I hope he's going to get a job somewhere to work some things. And he's asking me about economy is not good. I said, yes, I know, but, you know, I hope he's going to get some job, something. I hope economy is be better and everybody get a work, everybody have a job, everybody make a money. You know, no crimes, nothing, anything, you know.
How are your customers reacting?
Oh, my customers love me. You don't want to believe it, how many customers come over here. Everybody come to see me. Just come to see me, to the talk. Everybody give me a hug. Everybody. In Shirley, whole town is happy for me. They say, you're the boy, you're the man of Shirley.
I understand the would-be thief was wearing a mask, can't really identify him. So if he is caught, and if by some chance you could identify him, would you press charges against him for
absolutely,
trying to rob you?
Absolutely not, no. I help this person. If I press charge, then police arrest this person, then he go for long time in a jail. Who feed his family? Everybody, you know, they even have the job. They don't even have the money. Who feed his family, you know?
Mohammed Sohail is owner of the Shirley Express Convenience Store in Long Island. Mohammed, thanks very much and good luck to you.
Thank you, Deborah. Thank you, and God bless you, and God bless everybody.
And now this note, it's an important anniversary today, the 20th anniversary of the crackdown on democracy activists in China's Tiananmen Square. In China, officials are aggressively deterring any dissent. Foreign journalists were barred from the square. Uniformed and plainclothes police officers stood guard across the area. Tourists were allowed in the square as usual, but security officials appeared to outnumber the visitors. In Hong Kong, however, it was a different story. Tens of thousands of people turned out for a candlelight vigil in Hong Kong to mourn the demonstrators killed in Tiananmen Square. It's estimated that tens of thousands of people were killed in the crackdown on demonstrators there June 3rd and 4th in 1989. It's Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. With this next story comes a warning that some of the material that we're about to broadcast might be sensitive, especially for young ears. And the story is about one of the most high-profile crimes in New England. It prompted emotional calls for the death penalty. Even now, 12 years later, many people remember the horrific details of the kidnapping and murder of 10-year-old Jeffrey Curley. And they remember his father, Bob Curley, who led the fight for the death penalty in Massachusetts after his son's death, but he is now a death penalty opponent. We're going to talk with Bob Curley in a moment, but first, a look back at the case with this news clip from WCVB-TV in Boston after the arrest of Charles Janes and Sal Sicari for Jeffrey Curley's murder.
If you believe 21-year-old Salvatore Sicari, a neighbor of the dead boy, his homosexual lover, 22-year-old Charles Janes, killed Jeffrey Curley only hours after the little boy was reported missing.
Sicari stated that he was driving Janes' car while James is in the back seat with Jeffrey Curley. He stated that James smothered Jeffrey Curley with a gasoline-soaked rag until he suffocated.
Friends, relatives, neighbors of the dead boy arrived for the arraignments. When the prosecutor told the court James allegedly had sex with the boy after his death, most were infuriated.
That outrage intensified when it was revealed that one of the suspects was a member of the North American Man-Boy Love Association, a group that advocates liberalizing laws against sex between adult men and minor males. Both men, Sicari and Janes, had befriended Jeffrey Curley. They lured him into their car with the promise of a new bike, and they killed him after he turned down their sexual advances. They then stuffed the boy's body into a Tupperware container, which they dumped into a river in Maine. A devastated Robert Curley then led the campaign in Massachusetts for the death penalty.
Prominently displayed at the memorial to his son, a copy of a letter that Robert Curley has sent to acting Governor Cellucci, urging a death penalty.
The battle with the death penalty is going to be waged in the state house, and zero tolerance. Make a stand now with these predators that are out there. Do it now before they come and they abuse more of our children.
But despite Curley's tireless efforts, Massachusetts lawmakers rejected the death penalty, but by just one vote. Sal Sicari and Charles Janes were both convicted of Jeffrey's murder. Sicari sentenced to life without parole. Janes to life with the possibility of parole after 23 years. And 2 years after their convictions, Bob Curley went public once again, this time denouncing the death penalty. His journey is outlined in a new book titled The Ride. In it, Boston Globe reporter Brian McQuarrie documents the intense personal struggles of Bob Curley, a firehouse mechanic from Cambridge, Massachusetts, who goes from grieving father and death penalty advocate to still grieving father but death penalty opponent. And Bob Curley, can you describe what caused you to change your position on the death penalty?
When it all started with Jeffrey, I don't think, you know, people go through life thinking about the death penalty. I know I didn't give the death penalty much thought. And to all of a sudden have something like this happen to one of your loved ones. At that time, I don't know how anybody could not be in favor of the death penalty. But as time moves along, you know, you can take a step back and you can take a look at the death penalty for what it is. And that's basically what what happened with me. You know, after a period of time, I come to take a hard look at the death penalty.
When you were first advocating for the death penalty, you were obviously very adamant about it. When did the tide start to turn for you? When did you start to say, you know, this may not be something I want to go along with anymore?
When you see the legal process up close, it doesn't take long to figure out that what's right and what's wrong, justice and the law and what's right, who can afford a good lawyer, who can't afford a good lawyer. There's a big difference, you know. Even in this case here, I mean, James was the worst one of the two as far as I'm concerned. He had a good lawyer. He got second-degree murder with the possibility of parole. No disrespect to Arthur Kelly, the public defender that defended Sicari, but, you know, a public defender and Sicari got life without the possibility of parole. Right. So, you know, that just highlights that the justice system isn't always works perfect for everybody.
Was it difficult to start to tell people that you had changed your position?
Yeah. I just one day felt like talking about it. You know, it was close to Jeffrey's birthday, too. And I called a woman up from New England Cable, and I told her I wanted to talk about it publicly, that I had changed my position on the death penalty. And I went on TV, and it's strange the way things work, but that weekend was a conference at Boston College where anti-death penalty people from all over the country were there at this conference. And I wound up speaking at that conference that Saturday morning, and it just so happened to be Jeffrey's birthday that it happened. So it was just kind of strange the way, you know, the way things worked out.
Was it difficult to tell your family that you had changed your position?
Oh, yes. Because that afternoon, we have a ritual where we go to Jeffrey's grave on his birthday. And that day we did, and had some words with my older sons and Jeff's mom. But that's all right. They still have a different view than I do, but that's fine. I respect their view, and they respect mine.
You mentioned what you learned about the justice system and how that changed your opinion about the death penalty. What did you learn about the political system, do you think?
I don't think I realized the magnitude of what was going on at the time until after, you know, after things died down a little bit. And, you know, you'd see it on the news and afterwards speaking to some of the lawmakers and even reading parts of the book about things going on behind the scenes. You know, it was pretty surprising to see actually the emotion, the raw emotion that went in with state representatives and state senators and all the politics from the governor on down to the state representative.
It must not have tarnished you too much because you still work to sort of change things on a political level to a certain degree.
Yeah, I've been involved in a lot of different things as far as the 8 rules of safety, having them posted in schools where, you know, you might prevent a child from being abducted or worse, or sexually abused, and that type of thing. And that's really where I wanted to put my focus right from the start. And I think maybe the death penalty stuff, you know, it just got to a point where I just wanted it to go away. But on the other hand, I thought that it did give me a little bit of a platform to talk about what I really wanted to talk about, and that's the child's safety.
In the book, it also details how even after you had come to your decision on the death penalty to oppose it, that you also, things started to not go well for you, let's put it that way, and you started to have other problems as well because you hadn't dealt with some of the some of the initial issues from Jeffrey's death and the whole public battles that ensued after that. Would you say it's triumph is the message?
I always wanted the book to be about transformation, about healing, and about hope. You know, and it's not an easy process, but it is a process. You know, a family that, you know, God forbid, loses a loved one, and, you know, through an illness or an accident, there is hope. You know, you can get better. Not everybody does get better, but you can get better if you want to get better. The hardest thing is to just try to not let the anger surface up so much. You got to let it go. You can't let it eat you up.
How do you feel about them now? Do you forgive them?
No, I'm not. I'm not big in the forgiveness department with James and Sicari. No, I don't forgive them. It's not something you get over with. It's something you carry with you for the rest of your life. Something that's there. Something you manage. But on the other hand, you try to live your life the right way. Treat people the right way. I've said many times before, the best advice that I got was, you know, it's bad enough that James and Zachary had killed Jeffrey, and don't let them kill you. And it took a long time for that to click in with me. You know, the best way to honor Jeffrey is to live my life the right way, try to make as much positive come from what happened as I can.
That's Bob Curley, the father of murder victim Jeffrey Curley. His story is told in the new book, The Ride, by Boston Globe reporter Brian McQuarrie. You're listening to Here and Now. A Japanese woman is hoping to become a world boxing champion at the age of 46. Kazumi Izaki is already Japan's oldest professional boxer, and she juggles her training with making her children's lunches. Izaki was scheduled to fight 29-year-old Ana Maria Torres of Mexico for the world super flyweight title in February, but the bout was canceled because of concerns about Izaki's age and whether she could stand up to the hard-boxing Mexican. However, as the BBC's Tokyo correspondent Roland Burke reports, she's hoping for another shot at the title.
This is a gym in Yokohama outside Tokyo. There are young men here shadow boxing. In a corner in the ring, two others are sparring. There's encouragement from a coach. And we're here to meet a fighter who has serious ambitions of being a world champion. But Kazumi Izaki is no ordinary fighter. Not only is she a woman, she's 46 years old.
Yes, if I go for it, I'll be changing the world record that George Foreman had as the oldest person to hold title. Yet, yes, I do have a feeling ambitious to go for belt. And it's not because of my age. It's not so much for going for my record for age, but it's because I want that belt.
But the boxing authorities, you've had some difficulty with them, haven't you?
The WBC stopped the match that we were scheduled for. They stopped because of my age and they were worried about it. I believe the chance will come and I'll have a chance to try it again. And I hope so.
I understand you used to be an aerobics instructor. You don't look like the kind of person who likes hitting people. Why did you go into boxing?
Yes, I still don't like hitting people at all. And the reason I started boxing is because I was an instructor for aerobics and I wanted to learn how to teach boxercise as a part of exercise. And that's how I got into boxing. You know, I look at us not really hitting people, but it's a fight and defending. It's a defense as well as fight that comes with it. So I try to look at us not so much as hitting, and I still don't like hitting people.
So Sumu Hanagata is the manager of this gym. He's a former world flyweight champion. So I mean, you fought in the same weight class. Could you have beaten her? Do you think? Could you beat her now?
I don't think I can win. Then you know her left side punch is very strong. So once you know her left comes up, I don't think I have any chance to win.
Well, Sumi Izaki has managed to persuade the boxing authorities that she is capable of fighting, and she's hoping to have another shot at a world title in the summer.
That report from the BBC's Roland Burke in Tokyo. And joining us now for a look at the rest of the week in sports is our forever young commentator, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. And Bill, what do you think? 46? Too old to be duking it out or what?
Well, Deb, I'm on the record as saying that 2 is too old to be duking it out. I'm not a great fan of boxing. Gender notwithstanding, too much damage. Less so in the lighter weight classes, certainly less so with women. But just too much damage for that sport to be legitimized by my talking too much about it.
Okay. Well, let's move on then. National Basketball Association finals get underway tonight in Los Angeles. Kobe Bryant and the Lakers facing off against Dwight Howard and the Orlando Magic. What do you think, Bill? What are we in store for?
Well, I hope that we're in store for a great series. We've seen some terrific basketball in the playoffs so far. Denver was, you know, put up a better fight than a lot of people thought they might. And then, of course, everybody thought LeBron James and the Cavaliers would be in the finals, and that didn't turn out to be the case. Orlando was good enough to get rid of them. So I hope we continue to see great basketball. I hope the competition is still good. We all root for a seven-game series, of course. But there is this kind of nagging voice in the back of my head that says the Lakers will probably win.
Oh, okay, we got a prediction there. How about hockey? Game four of the Stanley Cup playoffs also tonight. Detroit leads that series 2-1 over Pittsburgh. Same two teams from last year. Mm-hmm. Detroit won last year. Are we going to see a repeat, do you think?
I would think probably so. I like Pittsburgh at home. They looked pretty good in Game 3, beat the Red Wings 4-2. That was really a 3-2 game. They got a late goal when the Detroit net was empty. But, yeah, I like them at home, but I guess I like Detroit in that one, too. That's a very, very strong hockey team.
Hmm. And let's move on to baseball. Pitching legend Randy Johnson, now with the San Francisco Giants, takes the mound against the Washington Nationals. If Johnson prevails, that will be his 300th career victory.
Mm-hmm.
You think Johnson will be the last 300 winner we ever see?
Well, you got Jamie Moyer pitching for the Phillies. Jamie Moyer is a young 46 or something like that. We had a 46-year-old boxer. One out of 46. Somewhere in that range. He has 250 wins, but Jamie Moyer hasn't thrown a fastball in the last dozen years or so. So, you know, maybe his arm isn't getting too tired. The problem, of course, the people who argue that you won't see another 300-game winner say teams have become so dependent on relief pitchers and their expectations for starting pitchers are so low. They don't expect them to go deep into games anymore. That's why you may not see another 300-game winner. But, you know, how long ago would people have said you'd never see a basketball player as good as Michael Jordan, and now they're talking about LeBron James in those terms, and
right. Someday
maybe there'll even be another Tiger Woods, so who knows?
Right. Well, speaking of fastball, though, who graces the cover of Sports Illustrated magazine this week? A baseball player at Las Vegas High School, Bryce Harper. He throws a 96-mile-per-hour fastball, and he's 16 years old. They're calling him baseball's chosen one. Sounds like a lot of pressure for a kid.
Yeah, and this is a kid who apparently welcomes the pressure. In the article in Sports Illustrated, he says not only that he wants to be in the Hall of Fame someday, but he wants to be known as the greatest player who ever lived. Now, you know, hey, why not shoot for the top? Baseball is awfully tough, though. This is a kid who's been playing with older kids for many years, but making the jump to professional baseball and Major League Baseball is a tougher jump than a lot of guys coming into basketball, for example, have found.
Well, we'll see. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. Special thanks today to WCVB-TV in Boston for providing audio from their coverage of the Jeffrey Curley murder case. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.